1935, the Lions win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
All right, here we go. I'm going to stick it in the ground. It's time for Detroit, City of Champions, the podcast. I'm Jamie Flanagan.
Charles Avison.
Charles, we are swinging away, man. We're having some fun with Walter Hagen and golf in general.
Yep. Yeah, no, this is, we're starting to finally dive into him a little bit.
Yeah.
And, kind of working on, it's the thing that's cool about him is how it is, like, the story of Walter Hagen is really, like, the evolution of modern golf. You know, that's where we've already touched on a little bit of, like, Mary Queen of Scots playing golf and talked about Walter Hagen, the caddy, and, now we're plowing right ahead into the greatest game ever played.
So, I was in Florida, which is Mecca for golf,
totally,
right?
Totally.
And I was reading some, just coffee table book, and Mary Queen of Scots, the word caddy comes into play because she was in France. She became queen when she was, like, one or something.
Yeah.
And then she was being educated in France, and she started playing golf in France. And the people that went to school, the boys were called cadets, and the boys had to carry her clubs for her, and that cadets became caddies. That's where caddies.
I can totally see it.
One of the stories.
Yeah, I can see that
where the word caddy came from, and there's lots of stories, and we're sharing them with you, and we appreciate that you're here, and we just want to do a little business and say thank you for listening, thanks for being there. Go to all the podcast places. And do all the podcast things. Like, subscribe, leave a comment, and then most importantly, tell a couple people, tell a couple friends, share it out. That would be extraordinarily helpful. So thanks for listening, and following us and wandering through these stories as Charles unfolds them for us.
We're both unfolding them, man. We're unfolding them together, and we say...
Like, I just have a frosty beverage and enjoy what's happening, really. That's pretty much my deal.
Well, I've got a warm beverage, and I enjoy what happens. But before we move into it, I just want to give a little mention, a little shout-out to a good friend of the show, a good friend of mine, David Marsh.
Hey, David.
David Marsh. If you remember, there was a show, we did a show like 6 months or a year ago. He gave me a windbreaker for Brighton football.
Oh, okay.
And so he's the freshman coach there, and he just got elected to the Michigan, I just want to be sure exactly what it is, the Michigan High School Football Coaches Association Hall of Fame.
Hey!
Yes, after an illustrious career. So we have we put his picture up on the screen there. I'm not going to read the entire thing right now because we got a lot to get into the show about.
Sure.
But you can read, you can kind of pause the show after and take a look at his credentials because they're extensive. And his wife, Wendy, is a dear friend of mine, and we just want to let them know that we're thrilled for them. So
a little shout out to David there.
Yep, some congratulations, David.
Hall of Fame, and we're dealing with just nothing but Hall of Famers.
Absolutely,
All 1935 was just creating.
That's why it's like Hall a perfect slide in for David. He's a Hall of Famer. We're sliding him into a series on Hall of Famers and people that are extraordinary sports stars.
So Walter Hagen, last time we were talking about him, we went from caddy to pro.
Mm-hmm. And so today we're going to be talking about the very next step, the very next year of his career, this is key because we left off with in 1912 where Walter he was talking about how he became the club pro at the Rochester Golf, the golf club of Rochester, and how it was like, I'm set. He's getting paid like a great salary. He's making clubs for people at the golf clubs for people.
Right.
He's got his dad a job as a groundskeeper. He's got, a couple of his friends working. This to me was like the most money I've ever
seen.
Life
is good.
Life is good. Like he could have just kind of done well from there on out, made that a career the rest of his life. And, the way that it works though is that, you're the club pro. And so Walter's young still. I mean, this is a guy who's only 20 years old at this moment.
Yeah.
And so he wants to go to compete. He's an athlete. We've talked about a little bit of how he was getting very, very good at baseball. His team's winning like the Rochester City Championship like 2 years in a row. He's already, he played in the Canadian Canadian Open. It was his first professional tournament in the previous year.
Right.
He finished, like, I think it was 15th. So he didn't, you know, he was, you know, basically a no-name finisher in the tournament. But he had his first tournament under his belt. And now, in 1913, which we're going to start today, he plays in his second professional tournament. And this, the reason why this is so special, we actually have the title of the show for episode 68 here, mm-hmm. as the greatest game ever played.
Yeah,
because this that's what this game is called. There's a Disney movie called The Greatest Game Ever Played, starring Shia LaBeouf. And have you seen it?
Yeah.
You just said that with a little hesitation.
No, I got a whole story.
Okay. Go ahead. Well, I want to hear it. Don't let us forget. Right. I want to hear your story, because you're giggling like a little school kid over there.
Yeah, no, because, well, when the movie came out, Shia LaBeouf came to town, and I got to sit down with him.
Oh, really?
With some of my student journalists. Yeah, so there was like one kid from Oakland University, two kids from Wayne State University, and then my three journalism students.
Really?
And we were at a room in the Townsend Hotel. And you know, we sat around a table just talking with Shia.
Oh, really?
And,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Was he in town for that movie?
Yeah, he was publicizing that movie.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah, and I was looking because I got a picture of like my three kids with him. I took some pictures while the interview was going on, and they're not on this computer, but I found the clip.
Well, you got to get that stuff.
There's the clip.
Okay.
Of you know, him sitting there at the table talking to the kids and. So, but that's it was
awesome.
Cool.
You got your clip. That's awesome, man. Yeah. That is a nice little tie-in.
Yeah. So, but it was great because he was there and he was talking about the movie, and it's like, so did you guys, you know, how much practice did you do? How'd you learn the game? You know, how much golf did you actually play? And he stops and he looks. He's like, we're not making fucking Bagger Vance here.
Like, well, it kind of is.
No, but you're bagging on. He was bagging on Will Smith. Like, they really didn't play real golf.
Oh, I got
in Bagger Vance. Okay. They were faking it out. These guys actually learned the golf and played it for the thing.
I got
And they faked it out. And he like, I'm like, man,
damn.
He's gonna get smacked by Will Smith.
Damn. Oh, damn. Yeah.
That was the funniest thing.
Yeah.
My kids are like, can we quote him on that? I'm like, no, you can't use
They put him in the school paper.
Can't use the F bomb.
School
in the,
assignments. Yeah.
So I mean, they dropped the F bomb. They used that quote without the F bomb.
Oh, did they?
In the school paper. Yeah. Yeah. So
that's amazing. That's awesome. That's a fantastic.
So yeah, I got to hang out with him when the movie came out.
Well, so the movie, so you have seen the movie then?
I have seen the movie.
And if anybody has not seen the movie, it's a fantastic movie. In fact, it's actually been a couple years, and I was like going, this morning I was like, hey, maybe I should watch this movie before the show today. And I'm like, I just kind of ran out of time. I was putting the notes together, and so I'm probably going to watch it tonight when I go home, because it actually is a really good movie. And I was looking at it just to kind of... I was looking at some of the things talking about the historical accuracy of it, and it's actually dead on. Like, there's only a couple of small things that are, you know, that they took a little bit, like, you know, that they twist
liberties
a little
with,
bit. Liberties, but otherwise, it's, you know, from everything I saw, it's actually very, you know, especially when you're comparing the facts that we're talking about today. I mean, it's pretty spot on. So, and it just gives you kind of an insight into the world of golf in this era that we're playing in. So, you know, highly recommend, give it a shot.
Give
it a, you know, it's a Disney movie. So if you got Disney,
Bagger Vance is a fun movie too.
That's a great movie. I love it.
It's a fun movie.
Walter Hagen's in that.
Yes.
Well, the guy who plays Walter Hagen. So it's cool to see him in it and the way that they portray him.
Yep.
So that's but I don't think Walter Hagen was in this one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't remember him. I looked at the cast, and it didn't show anybody playing Walter Hagen in it, because I haven't seen it in a while.
All right.
But I don't remember him being in this movie. I thought he was in the movie, but then when I looked at the cast, he's not mentioned. There's nobody that's mentioned as playing Walter Hagen.
Okay.
So, and I think that when I originally watched it, he's shown at the end on the score list on the list, but he is not shown as anywhere near even a minor character. They didn't put him in. So, anyways, while you're looking that up, to confirm or disprove that, you know, just to give, I would just want to kind of give, because what I want to do for the show is I want to just go through the events real quick, because this is, you know, this is an important signature moment in golfing history. This match at Brookline, Massachusetts, in 1913. Was absolutely massive for golf. It's essential for the storyline of the narrative of the overall story of the rise of Walter Hagen, and also Walter Hagen was there, but you know, he was a major part of it. He finished in the technically fourth But he was in the mix until the very last handful of holes. And so it's kind of a rare opportunity here, not just to introduce the story, but I want to kind of do an overall view of the story itself. And then I want to dive into the book because Walter Hagen's got an entire chapter titled Brookline 1913.
Yeah.
And so this is a perspective from Walter Hagen talking about this tournament. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's been a while today, just really summarize. I'm just going to read straight out of the book, but I think I did a pretty good job of slicing it down to the sort of essentials.
I would have laid money that the Walter Hagen character was in this movie.
I would have too. That's what I'm saying. I wanted to say that this is the guy that played Walter Hagen in this movie, but that's what I'm saying. I don't think I looked at the cast. I'm like, damn, he wasn't in it.
No, it's not coming up.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I wanted to watch it again to see, you know, who was, you know, how Walter Hagen was portrayed.
We must just be mixing our metaphors with the Bagger Vance and that, because
he was
very heavy.
Oh, massively, yeah.
Yeah.
So the American golfer in, there is an American golfer who's like the sort of a rival with, you know, the main character is Francis Ouimet.
Yeah.
And then there's like an American golfer who is like sort of his rival, but he's actually Johnny McDermott.
Right.
And so it's not Walter Hagen. Johnny McDermott, so there's like sort of a few central characters of the story.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Johnny McDermott, who is the background on the tournament a little bit. So this was a huge deal. This wasn't just some random, you know, this was the US Open. This was a major tournament.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And this is a major tournament, and it was at Brookline, Massachusetts. But golf was starting to, you know, golf was really trying to stretch its legs. It was really trying to, you know, it was really trying to flex its muscle a little bit and to say, you know, we're an emerging sport, like, you know, baseball. This is the golden era. You know, this is the, you know, this early era of baseball with like Ty Cobb. This is contemporary with Ty Cobb's, you know, heyday. This is, you're talking about 1913.
Mm-hmm.
This is even a little bit before Babe Ruth and that. I mean, this is like this sort of golden era of sports. And, you know, American professional sport is really starting to rise. And, you know, this was golf kind of looked at this as an opportunity, again, to sort of flex its muscle and to sort of join this emerging, you know, the ranks of sport. And so they wanted to go all out for this. And so to do that, they brought in, like, I mean, I don't think they paid for him to come in, but they are able to at least attract the two biggest name golfers in the world at the time, which were the two British golfers, one named Harry Vardon, and the other is Ted Ray. And both of these two are like just the biggest names in the world of golf. I mean, if you look online, you see like sports cards and like tobacco cards with their, you know, with their images on it. These were major names, and they were Brit. And because they were both British, they were like really top of the heap when it came to, it kind of gave Britain, you know, Britain had sort of been known as like the hub for golf. Like, this is where the best golfers came from. Like, America was like sort of like, you know, they were just, you know, second class citizens in the world of golf. Yeah, we had the major, we had US Open, but it was, you know, golf was just, it wasn't really, you know, I don't want to say it wasn't big, but it, you know, and the people that liked it was big, but the British were known as like the superior golfers overall, superior tournaments, superior golfers. That's the sort of area it was. So the fact that these two British, you know, these two British stars are coming over to golf at this specific tournament was a big deal. And so, you know, and so just a little credentials of each. Harry Vardon had won the US Open in 1900. And then he'd also won five, you know, they call it the Open, which is really the British Open. He'd won five British Open championships and one US Open. So this guy's a stud.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Ted Ray had won the previous British Open in 1912, like the very previous year he'd won that. And then Johnny McDermott, who's really the biggest American professional, he was the first American player to win his own US Open. Like, all the previous U.S. Opens had been won by Brits.
Oh.
And so he's the first American to win, and he won in 1911 and 1912. So the two previous Open tournaments in U.S. Open, you know, championships went to Johnny McDermott.
Okay.
So entering this tournament, you've got Johnny McDermott, who is the American rep, who's won the previous two U.S. Opens,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got two British superstars coming in. To play, to be part of this, to challenge Johnny McDermott for the U.S. Open, and it's at this point where Francis Ouimet comes in, because he's an amateur, And so golf, as we, you know, as we're talking about here, about how, you know, these people that were like the kind of old school guys, they wanted these amateurs, they almost wanted these amateurs to be superior because it would prove like the gentlemanliness, that like kind of gentlemanliness trumps like the mercenary, you know, like a paid player is not as good as somebody that plays it for the love of the game. So they wanted a guy who was going to be good that could potentially give these guys a run, you know, and therefore kind of demonstrate that amateurism is like still like, you know, an underappreciated, you know, virtue. And so Francis we met, he'd won a tournament earlier in that year. He won the Massachusetts Amateur Championship, but overall, like from what I've seen, he wasn't particularly interested in doing this. He felt like he was sort of overmatched going against these professionals and these biggest names that there was. But the president of the U.S. Golf Association specifically went to him and said, because usually you have to like kind of write in and you know to get a slot in the tournament. But he actually went to him and said, like, look, man, we want you to be here at this tournament.
You got to represent us, man.
Yeah, you got to represent the golf. But the same thing was that Francis we met, kind of like where Walter Hagen was a caddy for the Rochester Country Club and lived across the street, Francis we met was the caddy for this particular Brookline course, and he lived across the street, so he had a very similar background as Walter Hagen, you know. And so his super special, like his super secret weapon was the fact that he knew this course better than anyone else out there. So everybody's like, oh, he had no chance. But when you've played that course like 1,000 times,
you got a little bit of a chance. Yeah.
You got a little bit of an advantage.
Every bump and bumble, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly. So he had that going for himself. So that's who's, you know, that's who's, so that, that's like the sort of group that is about to take part in this. And of course, there's a big field too. And, but sort of, we'll get to Hagen in a second. But just the overall, like, sort of how it all went down was, we'll talk about the rainy conditions, how awful it was. Hagen's got a great, sort of quote about that. But the thrill of this event came in the final day. They'd golf for 3 days. You know, you play three sets of golf, three sets of 18 holes over 3 days.
Yeah.
And on the third day, the two British golfers, Vardon and Ray, were both like winning. They were both like kind of neck and neck for the lead. And Francis we met was hanging with them and he was two strokes down with six holes left to play.
Oh boy.
And then he rallies and has a great series of holes to rally up and tie with them on the final hole, which sets up this massive, like the next day, a tiebreaker. It's an 18 hole tiebreaker. So it extends onto an extra fourth day.
Wow.
And when that happens, this 18 hole playoff, it becomes this massive thing. I mean, you can see why. I mean, the way that they portrayed it is you've got an amateur 20-year-old in Francis we met who's like started off on this very course as a caddy.
Yeah.
And he's standing up against the two biggest names in the world of golf, you know. And besides that, he's going against the British who are the dominant golfers in the world. And here's an American who's playing for American pride. I mean, everything you could ever. When you see the movie, the movie doesn't exaggerate the excitement. I think that's what probably the best thing about the movie is how they nail just how people really got excited, because it's just, I mean, when you look at the credentials of sort of what came after this, they say, you know, there's the biggest crowds ever seen at an American golf. Tournament, and that not for the tournament, but just that day,
right.
fourth day, like all these crowds were showing up, and it became this national news story. It was in the car. It was like cut front page news of every newspaper in the country. Told David and Goliath, easy to market story, which you can see why. So we met, finished one shot under par, which was five shots ahead of Vardon and six shots ahead of Ray.
Boom.
And so he wins the tournament, a massive upset, first amateur to win a U.S. Open. It just becomes, like I say, it brings golf. I mean, this is beyond what these people, what these golfer, golf association could have hoped for, because, talk about flexing some muscle. This is like a sport that is now, widely known amongst people. And like, maybe somebody saw a game of golf and goes, this game is like watching grass grow or something, If they thought it was boring, well, all of a sudden now they're getting reports that this incredible match just happened. And like, hey, maybe this is, opportunity to, maybe this might be something I'd be like to get interested in. But they talk about there's a list of credentials about this, about how big, you know, about the impacts of this very specific game. The mainstream press goes crazy. We Met's a star, at least for a short time. I mean, yeah. it was a bit of a flash in the pan. I mean, he was famous throughout the rest of his life, but not like it wasn't like that fame. Like it just got bigger and bigger over the years. Mm. It was like really sort of a moment in time, I think. But again, it doesn't mean that he disappeared. I mean, he was still, sure. he was still doing tournaments and winning stuff the rest of his life, but as an amateur. But, and also, so like, whereas, you know, Britain had previously dominated golf, now America is sort of now on the scene of golf. And then you've got, there's some metric that I saw where it was talking about how the number of American players in America tripled over the course of the next 10 years. And then golf courses just became to pop up all over the place.
Yeah.
And like, whereas golf was like previously, you know, sort of like super exclusive. You had to be like a very special club and, you know, belong to some super rich club. Now you start to see like public courses where just the general public can go and get a game of golf and for a certain amount. Yeah. So it just led to this. It brought golf out a little bit more into the mainstream world. So it was a really significant, this is a significant event in the history of golf and certainly worth our, worth the effort to cover.
Do you golf at all?
I have. Yeah, I have.
Because you're in Scotland.
Yeah, I told you that story I had. I was possessed by the golfing gods.
Yeah. One of my favorite public courses used to be out on Belle Isle. They had a little par three, a small little golf course.
All right, I didn't even know you golfed.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's where my dad got his first hole in one.
Really?
On the Belle Isle. And it was like a hole. It was a hole you got to go over some water. And so, you grab a crappy ball because you're like, I'm going to put it in the water, right?
Yeah.
So what's he do? He takes this crappy ball right in the hole.
Jeez.
Because you get your hole in one, right? You take that ball and, you put it on your mantle at home, right?
What an amazing.
You had a crappy water ball.
Yeah, but what an amazing feeling, though, dude. Could you imagine getting a hole in one? Oh, that's the greatest. You're like, I mean, after this, like, it's all downhill. Like, this is the peak of the mountain. I've just got a hole in one in golf.
Well, and then they retired and they split their time between here and North Fort Myers in Florida. And they did a little trailer park and there's a little par three golf course, really short.
Yeah.
Little par three golf course that runs through it. But, so yet they jump on and play every day, whenever they want. So he was playing it and he got a bunch of hole in ones
there.
So I mean, like three or four.
Well, your dad?
Yeah.
Dude, what is he, some kind of a hole in one master?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, it's like, that's like a par three course. It's like, they're all like, you can,
so that doesn't you can mean hit it's the easy. Green. The ball is that big. The hole is that big. And you're drilling and it from 180 about, yards away or whatever.
Well, no. I mean, these are all like 60, 70. I think the longest hole is 120 yards.
It doesn't diminish the achievement of it. Because you're using a club that looks like, it's like shillelagh cane.
So I got him a golf towel.
Drill it over there.
So
three or four? How many did he hit?
Yeah, three or four. I don't know. I forget. I think it was four, but there was one of the holes he got twice. He got a hole in one twice.
Oh, my God.
On the same. But so I got him so there's nine holes, a little nine-hole course that goes through. So I got him a golf towel. That had the numbers 1 through 9 on it, and then I had it was embroidered with the numbers 1 through 9
crossed,
and
out.
Then I had the holes that he got the hole in ones on X'd out,
Damn.
And so he loved that towel. And I'm like, that's you got to get some more. I want to X out some more for you. I'll take it back and I'll embroider another X.
That's
on
the first
it,
person so. I've ever known to get a hole in one, man.
Yeah.
I've never even heard of anybody.
Well, I did once, but
did
it's
you, really?
You know, yes, yeah, right through that clown's mouth.
Oh, and yeah, then, I know. That's what I was going to. That was the next thing I was going to say was, yeah, I've had a few hole in ones, a few.
Bounced off the windmill.
Your dad's probably had more hole in ones than I have hole in ones on the putt putt greens, man. Like, I've had a couple on the
right
putt putt course, but.
Right in there.
But no, that's awesome. I had no idea. So we're going to get into Hagen now from his perspective from Brookline. And there's actually kind of it's not a hole in one incident, but it's something similar for his experience, which is actually kind of a cool little story.
This comes out of the Walter Hague story, the Hague himself.
This is coming out in his own mouth. So I just think it's kind of a cool opportunity to talk about, Hagen's experience here, because in the movie he wasn't, you see at the very end of the movie when they show the scoreboard that his name is on there.
Yeah.
And I thought he was in it.
I would have laid money. Yeah.
Yeah. And so here he is. he's talking about his experience there. And so this is a firsthand eyewitness about what, you know, and I don't know how many eyewitnesses there are to this tournament. I mean, I don't even know if Francis We Met has a book and talks about it, or if any of the officials, I mean, this, as far as I know, this is the only firsthand source saying like that's there talking about the color and
besides
the pageantry
the
and the rain
articles,
and stuff.
Yeah. Sitting back post and reflecting. Yeah, interesting.
That's what I'm saying. So this might be the only. I don't know. But, yeah. I mean, it's a, you're going to see. I think it's a pretty good sort of overall description of what it was like there. So
mm-hmm.
So diving right in. So this is 1913. He's coming off. This is his second tournament. And he's – all right. So this is Walter Hagen. When I sent my entry that summer, I believe I was more concerned about the clothes I planned to wear than I was about the kind of game I'd have to play. The outfit had cost me plenty of money, $10 for the shoes alone. But I had managed to copy Tom Anderson's getup as closely as it could be done. My pure silk striped shirt sported as many bright colors as Tom's, and I had that red bandana knotted so casually around my neck. My white buckskin shoes with thick red rubber soles were laced with the widest white laces I had been able to find. In the white flannels, I had the cuffs turned up just once, perfect for the well-dressed golfer or any active sportsman. So he's talking about his clothes, right? So he says, you know, that's his focus is he's thinking about more about his clothes and his look. You know, he's about to make this is his real entrance onto the real stage here, and he's like, I gotta look like there's a guy Tom Anderson he talks about it in the book how he saw this guy and he was like the poetic picture of a perfect golfer, and he's like all he wanted to do was emulate this guy. And so he was saving up his money to acquire all the pieces of clothes he needed to look just like this guy, including the fold of his cuffs, just, you know, turned up just once,
hey.
Not twice, because then you can start to look like a rube, you know. He's like, no, just the one cuff flip. And so and he devotes a ton of time in this book talking about his outfits and stuff, man. Mm-hmm. He's got a whole section, which it's too long to talk about it right now, but he talks about all the gear and all this that he wore. And so anyways, so I'd scratch hard to buy that first pair of white flannels, and I rode the day coach to Boston in September of 1913. I checked in at the Copley Plaza, for I was determined to live first class in keeping with the outfit I planned to wear in the golf course. The manager gave me directions for reaching the country club. I mean, the country club. It says, as the golf club in Brookline was known. So it's the with, like, capital the. The country club.
The country club.
As the golf club in Brookline was known, and I lost no time in getting out there. So so that's like him, you know, talking about him getting himself dressed up. And so so this is a short time later. He goes to the clubhouse. You're Johnny, or the locker room. You're Johnny McDermott, aren't you? I asked. Well, I'm glad to know you. I'm W.C. Hagen from Rochester, and I've come over to help you boys take care of Varden and Ray. That brought some laughter, of course, and a lot of kidding from the pros who were listening, but I didn't mind. I was meeting and seeing the greats of the game. I met Varden and Ray, who'd both won the British Open Championship, and Varden was touted as the best player in the world. As I expected to become the best, I decided to keep my eye on him. In fact, I stood around and gawked at him like any other greenhorn from the pastures. So that's him sort of meeting these players. Mm-hmm. So that's him talking about Ray and McDermott and Varden. So now he's going to talk about Francis We Met. I heard a little about Francis We Met in the locker room. The pros were not permitted in the clubhouse proper, which must have made Varden and Ray feel right at home. But We Met, who had won amateur tournaments around the state, was admitted and welcomed to the clubhouse. He was a popular young fellow of 19 and had a big following. However, since he was so young and an ex-caddy like me, few figured he could beat the top pros in either the American or the foreign group. Nobody gave me a tumble. I had no background other than my entry in the Canadian Open of the year before, and that rated me no consideration as a contender. But in the end, Francis We Met and I carried the fight for America, and he won. Francis We Met made golfing history that day and became a national sports hero. He put golf on the front pages of the newspapers, and in the roar of the crowds for the great golf he played in the Open that year, all sidelights were forgotten. But I was in that championship tournament too, and while I failed, I was there right up to the 14th hole of the final round. Through the 13th hole, I was tied with Varden and Ray, who were playing a few holes in front. I had a 12-foot putt for a birdie 3 on the 13th green to go a stroke in front of the two Englishmen, but my ball rimmed the cup. My par 4 kept me even with them. To be honest, I was not thinking about We Met, who was playing behind me, for I was engaged in a chase after the big shots from over the seas. So he's talking about he didn't even...
He didn't even see him coming up behind.
He wasn't even thinking about Weedmatt. Right. He was gunning for those two, sure. And he was on their heels. You know, he was right there.
As was Weedmatt.
Yeah, and so was Weedmatt. But he was like, I wasn't even focusing on him.
I was focusing
on the big boys.
It's like, holy crap, here he comes. That's amazing.
So he's talking a little bit about the weather right here. So he says, I've rarely seen worse weather for a championship. It rained and rained and continued raining. In the air was chilling and cold. On the final day of the play, the fairways were a soggy mess. My handsome golfing outfit, wet and soiled, clung to me limply, but that had become unimportant. By the end of the third round, I was only two strokes behind Varden and Ray, and a few people had begun to notice the kid from Rochester. And so, so that's like the weather and where he's, you know, how he's getting there. Mm-hmm. So now he's talking about, all right, so here we go. So he's talking as he's progressing. Here's the thing. So he starts out horribly in the final round.
Oh.
So his first three holes, like it's a huge description, but it's really bad. He starts out awfully. This is the final day, and he says, I just did terribly in the first three holes. So anyways, I'm not easily rattled, but I certainly felt that way while I was making a 7 at the third hole in the final round of the National Open and watching my chances fade away.
That'll do it.
Yes. I wondered what they'd think of me back home. I was really discouraged, but I couldn't give up, for here I was in the biggest event of my life to date, and I had to continue to give it all I had. Walking over to the fourth tee, this is an incredible story, listen to this. Walking over to the fourth tee, I began thinking about Harry Vardon's stance and swing. I needed a miracle. At the tee, I took what I thought was the correct Varden posture, and after three practice swings, I hit a beautifully straight drive. But this fourth hole at the country club provides a blind second shot. It only requires a 5-iron off a good drive to get home, but the green is concealed by a hillock. I remembered walking up to take an observation of the ground. That was really optimistic for a guy who had blown wide open in the last three holes. I looked the ground over and happened to see a boy running out of the woods behind the green. I went back, took my 5-iron, and hit what I figured was a fine shot. I was sure it landed on the green and was wondering if I were close enough to hole a putt for a birdie. When I walked to where I could see the green, however, my ball was not in sight. I had a hunch that the boy I'd seen running out of the woods had picked it up. I yelled at him far down the fairway and sent my caddy after him with orders to search him. Meantime, I went hunting through the rough.
Oh, no.
Then my playing partner thought to look in the hole, and there was my ball nestled real snug-like. I had scored a deuce. I figured right then that the two would take care of the 7 on the previous hole.
Yeah.
So now he's right back in it.
He's back in it.
He didn't even know he'd hold it.
So, where the hell's my ball? Get that kid.
Get that kid. He searched the kid. He's like looking everywhere except for in the hole.
Got him by his ankle, shaking him.
So he's like, so my assistant, you know, had the bright idea to look in the hole, and there it
man.
Is. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah, so
after the deuce came a birdie three at the fifth. At the next hole, a drive and a pitch, my drive was perfect. The second I hit a bit too firmly and the ball hit a flag, and then so look at this. The second I hit a bit too firmly and the ball hit the flag at the top of the pole.
Nope.
But it caught in the folds of the flag and dropped down besides the cup. Another 3.
God.
So this guy, that's like...
This should have been part of the movie.
I know. This is a recurring thing with him. There's people going to be saying, like, this guy can hit the worst holes you've ever seen and then, like, have miracle shots. Like, it hits the flag. It gets caught up in the flag and drops.
I've done that. I've done that, yes.
So he said, I had lost four strokes to par. I had lost 4 strokes to par in the first three holes and recovered them in the next three. He's like, now I was back in the running again. So the eighth, a par 4 hole, I managed to mess up by taking a 5. Coming to the ninth, a long par 5, I finally got on the green in 3, but I was putting badly and wound up taking 3 putts. My chin dropped a bit and I felt sick. When I reached the 10th tee, a few people who had heard of my run of 2-3-3-3 from the 4th through the 7th wanted to know what I'd gone out in. I told them somewhat gruffly, wondering what difference it made now. I'm out in 40. My small gallery began buzzing, and one fellow said, "That's fine." Fine, I thought disgustedly to myself. Then I asked the man who'd made the remark, "What's fine about it?" He informed me that Varden and Ray had both gone out in 42, which made me even with them, and in 9 holes yet to play. the word got around, and I began to pick up my first sizable gallery. So he's like, what's fine about it? And we're like, the other dudes
were sucking in the 70s here. It's like,
well, they're like, yeah, well, so are they. Yeah, you're good. Yeah, and he's like, oh, dude, okay, I'm in. And then the gallery starts to grow around him.
All right.
So spectators kept me informed about Vardon and Ray, and when I reached the 13th green, I barely missed a 12-foot putt that would have given me a one-stroke lead. Lady Luck left me at that hole and probably went over to take care of Francis We Met, who I've heard needed her badly about that time. And that's what that where he's referring to is this huge comeback that he had in this final day. So where he was coming back, this is when he sort of imploded at that exact moment. So it's been 41 years since that National Open at Brookline, but every shot is as vivid in my mind as though it were yesterday. The penetrating drizzle of rain, the wet grass, my red rubber-soled shoes slipping precariously on the soggy turf, my desperate shift into the Vardon swing, that fatal 14th hole. And he's got a huge description. Like, he's not lying when he says that the 14th hole, he remembers every detail.
Oh, man.
I can't go. It'll be the next 10 minutes. He analyzes every grass blade and every, like, it's like you can tell this is one of like the biggest regrets.
But
of his
ultimately,
life.
What happened?
Because
on
that 14th. Was 14th destroyed him, and so that's what he got a. So he says, "I took a 7 and rolled myself right out of the championship. I took a 7 after all these great holes."
Yeah.
I says, "I played the last four holes in the same figures as Vardon and Ray, and finished with a 307, three strokes behind them. The three strokes I lost on the 14th hole, I tied for second place with McDonald Smith, Jim Barnes, and Lewis Tellier." We Met came in later to tie Vardon and Ray, and the three of them played off a first-place tie the following day and finished up in that order. A little luck on that 14th hole, and I would have been in that playoff. So he was just there. He missed by that one thing.
Yeah.
And so this is what's kind of interesting I'll just read it. So this is like the final little quote. So back in the locker room, I got my gear together, and after assuring the fellows I'd see them next year, I went into Boston and took the train for Rochester. I was disappointed I had made such a mess of that crucial hole. I should have been right up there at the top, but I wasn't. However, after I reached home, I wondered why I hadn't stayed at Brookline and followed Vardon around the next day. I could have learned plenty more from him, but I didn't think about that until after I got home. He wasn't even there on the final day.
Oh, wow. So he was like,
the whole world is at this is the biggest attended
golf event of
in history. Like,
yeah.
I mean, like, they made a movie about it.
Yeah.
And it's probably the last.
And he was like, screw it. I'm going, but yeah, you know, that 14th hole,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, devastated.
That get in your head. Yeah. Screw it. I'm going home.
Everybody else in the world is like,
going there. He's like on the train.
I'm out.
It's like, wow, traffic's really light getting out of here.
and he doesn't even regret missing the day for like how exciting it was. He regrets not standing there watching Vardon
to learn
more. That's his regret. He doesn't sit there and go, oh, I really wish I would have seen this incredible finish. He says, I wish I would have seen Vardon, who didn't even win the tournament. Like, that's how much respect they all had for him. And he said he had his miracle turnaround when he started copying Vardon's swing. So he's like, I would have maybe improved if I had stayed and watched him in that final. You know, he didn't care about, like, he said. I just thought it was kind of interesting because he's like, he didn't say, you know, like, oh, man, I missed that last day. You know, everybody in the world is watching it except for me. I was on the train. So that's Walter Hagen's perspective on it. I thought it was kind of a cool little
segment. Does he talk anything about the little caddy from the Greatest Game?
He doesn't talk about him in there.
Right.
But we have the picture on the screen with him on it.
So, because that's all part of the little story there with
Ed Lowry. Real. The caddy's real,
Then caddying for We Met. Yeah. And then the rejoicing afterwards.
Yeah. And there's like, we got the photos side by side with the with the cover of the movie.
That's good stuff. That's so where's Walter at now? So he's the pro up in New York, right?
Yeah.
And
but he's only he's young. He's
20,
is,
right? No, yeah, no. We Met's 20. How old's
Hagen's 20 as well.
Oh, okay.
And Hagen calls him 19 in here, but I've read elsewhere that he was 20. So okay. I mean, there's some thereabouts. But Hagen's 20 years old at this moment too. So you know, this guy's 20 years old. So this is his first major tournament. This is only the second tournament he was ever in. Mm-hmm. The last tournament when he was an assistant pro, club pro. He wasn't even a head guy or anything. So this is where he's at. He's headed back to Rochester. He's bummed for losing, but everybody, when he gets back to Rochester, we're going to talk about it next week, but when he gets back to Rochester, everybody there is like, man, you're awesome. You were in this game, man.
You were right in the game.
You were right there with them all.
So we're going to talk about next week.
But we're going to get into it next week. What's going to be kind of interesting is that he's actually, you know, sort of at this moment, he can kind of write his own ticket in golf.
Yeah.
You know, or at least, you know, maybe try out, you know, go for the next shot. But it's going to be odd because he's going to get a chance with the Philadelphia Phillies in baseball. He's going to, that's what I'm saying. This guy's interesting, man. He's going to get a shot.
What is he, Golden Tate?
He's going to get a shot in baseball for the Philadelphia Phillies.
All right. I think Golden Tate's playing baseball now.
I don't know. I didn't hear anything about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Football player?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know. I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because he was a two-sport athlete at Notre Dame when he was a ball player.
Huh. No, I didn't know. I had no idea.
So, yeah.
I'd say more like a Deion Sanders or something, but I've never heard of like a golfer that plays golf.
Yeah, no, golf and baseball. That's a little.
The only golfer baseball player I've heard is Schoolboy Rowe.
Right.
Who won a golf championship on the same day as he actually won the golf tournament on the same day as he won a bunch of track and field events. So he won a bunch, but he was a baseball player at the same time he was golfing. I don't think we did enough time
on Schoolboy Row.
No, we didn't, dude. We need to do way more shows on him.
We got to get back to our Tigers roster.
Yeah, don't even get me started on Schoolboy Row. This show is going to go an hour and a half. I'm going to be like, from El Dorado, there's one of my favorite quotes of Schoolboy Row. They're like, you'll hear some say that gold, this person is worth their weight in gold. And they're like, if that were true, then Schoolboy Rowe would be worth $100,000 or like 50, maybe as they said, $50,000. He goes, a paltry $50,000 for Schoolboy Rowe? I think not. Like, that's what the quote starts out saying. They're like, we wouldn't trade him for $50,000. It'd be like $500,000. He's like, so Schoolboy is worth more than his weight in gold. But anyways, but that's like the only person I've heard that's like a two sport, you know, golf and baseball star.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, so Hagen next week's going to be, we're just going to talk about his opportunity with the Phillies.
Well, and if you want to catch that episode, here's the best way to do it.
Click subscribe.
Leave a comment. Yeah. Do all those podcast things in all the podcast places.
Like, subscribe, tell your friends.
Yeah.
Click on the button. Yeah, click the button. And then the biggest thing is, besides subscribe, is if you select the alert button on your subscription tab, it'll alert you when we go live.
Yeah, you'll know. Because
exactly
we do these relatively the same time, depending on work and how life gets in the way.
No, yeah, we try. I think we do pretty good.
We might be shifting back to Tuesdays. I don't know.
We can try it all.
So, but yeah, normally, I mean, people listen wherever, whenever, however. But a lot of times we're recording on Thursday nights.
Yeah.
At present, when we're around episode 68.
68, man. So I think it's pretty good.
Most
shows been
80% of podcasts don't make it past the 12th episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Man, it's like they say, oh, there's 4 million podcasts. There are. But 80% of those aren't recording anymore.
Yeah.
It's the number of podcasts that are like have recorded more than 10 episodes and recorded in the last 6 months. The number drops down to
really?
Like 400,000 or something, which is still a crap ton of podcasts.
Yeah.
But it's not 4 million, 5 million podcasts.
I didn't know that. I know that's good, man.
So
I think 68 is a pretty. I mean, that's a pretty solid number. That's 68 hours of at least. Each show is about an hour long.
Yeah.
So that's. I mean, we put some time into this, man. I'm pretty proud of it.
I know. I my liver can probably take about another 68 more. So we thank everybody who listens and follows along. Chris chimed in. Catherine Gonzo said hello.
Long time no see, guys.
As well. So
thanks for listening to them.
Diamondbacks in 2007. Chris said, yeah, Tate was drafted by the Diamondbacks in 2007, out of high school. I think he's back to baseball now.
Interesting. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Good luck to him.
So I did a bunch of work for him when he was here in Detroit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So I my kids. He did these big celebrity bowling things. It's like bowling with the Lions, and you'd pay like crap tons of money, and you just hang out with them, drinking all night. But I mean, like all the Lions were there.
Oh, that's
like
cool.
Calvin Johnson was there. Stafford was there. I mean, everybody was there, and it was all for the military. It was all for, veterans. All the money they raised went to like local veteran and like I like more current veterans, you know, like Iraq and Iran veterans, so younger dudes that were struggling, and they would, but so yeah, people would pay, and you know, they'd just be bowling, and you know, the lines would be coming on and off the lanes and bowling with people, and it was fun. So we were video, I photographed it and had a couple kids photographing it for their socials. Yeah. And shot some videos and produced little videos for their socials and stuff. So him and his wife, Elise, really good people.
That's cool. No, I always seemed like it. I always, you know, thought he was a pretty good player and everything. Solid athlete. Never, you know, there's never any kind of controversy with him, so that's how you can kind of tell.
Then so Shia LaBeouf. I can't wait till next week, and I can drop more. Well, I can do more name dropping.
Whenever I hear Shia LaBeouf, like it's always the video that he put out where it's just interesting. Have you seen the video where he puts out? He's like, just do it.
God,
it's like burned into my brain.
Oh my God, he's like such a flip chicken.
I know he is, but there's something about it where you know, he's not the first one I've ever heard to say something like that. You know, his manner is a little awkward, I think, but. You know, there's something to be said for, you know, for like, you're like, you know, when you're going, I don't know if I should do that. And then you're like, just do it. And you're like, you know what? I'll listen to Shia LaBeouf.
I'm just going to do it.
You know what? I'm going to take his advice because he seems like he's pretty passionate about this particular message.
Yeah. All right. We're going to wrap it up and we're going to do it all again. And there you go. Like, subscribe, leave a
nice
comment.
Nice fade out. You're supposed to fade to the end
I forgot. Yeah, I forgot how it is. So we'll stick it in the ground again next time.
Way to go. You put some time into that closure.
It's Detroit City
Champions. Smooth finish by Jamie Flanagan.
Bye.
Come tune in for the smooth
finish. Bye.